Welcome. You're listening to the Mac Observer's Background Mode. This is your host, John Marcellaro, and this week my guest is science fiction author Darren Beyer. Darren, welcome to the show.
Thanks, John. Very happy to be here.
Nice to have you. So for the listeners, I want to introduce you. You are a former NASA space shuttle engineer at Kennedy Space Center who worked on the launching and recovery of more than a dozen missions, including the Hubble Space Telescope. You also conducted astronaut training and had the honor of working on board every space shuttle orbiter except Challenger. In late 1998, you left NASA to become an entrepreneur and lately an author. The first result of that was the Angazi series of novels, Casimir Bridge, which I've started reading, released in 2016 to rave reviews, thanks largely to your commitment to putting the science back in science fiction. Yay, we'll talk about that. And in the second installment, we have The Pathogen Protocol released this month, well, October 10th, actually, 2018. So that's the introduction, Darren. That's pretty impressive. Thanks for joining me on the show.
Again, thanks for having me.
So did you always want to work for NASA when you were young? Was that the out-of-the-gate dream?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. A lot of kids set goals when they're really young, and many go different ways. I actually kept to mine, and it started when my mother got me up at, you know, O-Dark 30, and we were watching one of the Apollo landings on our 19-inch curved corner black and white TV. And from that point forward, I was so enthralled by it that that point forward, I knew that's what I wanted to do. So everything I did through high school, you know, I went to the college that I thought could most get me there, and took all the courses, et cetera, to work for the space program, and got really lucky. I wish I could say I'm just that was that great of an engineer and great of a student, and NASA had to have me, but really it was a lot of luck. I think that happened with. I think a lot, you know, happens with a lot of people, right? You just get in the right place in the right time. In my case, I said the right things on my resume and was able to get the dream job right out of the gate.
So it sounds like you didn't even need to read any science fiction to be inspired. You were already greatly inspired.
Well, the science fiction stuff was in there too. And, you know, I was one of those guys, even at a young age, you know, we were standing in lines around the corner to get tickets for Star Wars. We were hiding out in bushes overnight in the mall to get tickets. I mean, so I always loved the science fiction stuff and science fiction fantasy movies and things. Even, you know, then when it wasn't really in vogue, it's something that's always, always really captured my attention.
When I was a NASA summer intern in 1977, I stood in line to watch Star Wars, came out of the movie, got right back in line again.
Right. We used to switch movie theaters, right? So the movie would let out and we would sneak because you're in your teens. And so what's somebody going to do to you? So we'd sneak into the bathroom and then wait for everybody to exit. And then we'd come back out and get into the next theater that was running, you know, one that's a half an hour off, just so we could see some of the stuff again.
So I read you decided to pursue aerospace engineering at Virginia Tech. What led you to VA Tech?
Well, I was, born and raised. I was born in D.C., raised in Virginia. Spent early years overseas until I was about 6 years old. Basically, until us kids got old enough to really appreciate that we were living overseas. Then my parents moved to suburban, USA, and grew up outside Washington D.C. And then Virginia Tech was a natural choice just because it had a top 20 engineering school. At the time, was exceedingly reasonable tuition. It's changed since then, but so it just kind of made sense to go there. They had just a great program all the way around.
Isn't there a NASA facility there in Maryland? Is that Goddard?
Yeah, there's a bunch. I mean, you got headquarters downtown, of course. Not right. A tremendous amount of stuff happens there. You've got Goddard, which is not too far away. I applied there. Didn't get any looks from that side. There's one at Wallops Island also, which is more down toward the lower right corner of Virginia along the coast. Mm-hmm. So those are the ones that are sort of close by. But frankly, I mean, I was pretty happy with where I landed. I had about the best job you could possibly have for NASA, at least I think so.
So what did you do? What were your first duties at NASA Kennedy? And then how did you get into the orbiter program?
Yeah, it was that all the way along. I talked a little bit about getting lucky on the wording on my resume. I said that I wanted to be involved in spacecraft payload operations, and it just so happened at exactly that time that I sent that in, they were starting a new NASA, what they call the quote-unquote payload operations group. So it was like perfect wording, and that caught my future boss's eye. So we had the interview process, et cetera. He liked what he saw, and I was able to come on board. And basically, the group that I worked in, everybody would work on – we were one of the very few organizations that would work alongside contractors. So there were contract engineers, there were NASA engineers. And we did the same job. It doesn't mean we did exactly the same thing on the same stuff. It means that we were essentially one office. And the reason it was set up that way was during the Apollo era, there was a huge, you know, massive upbuild of engineering talent in for NASA. And then there was a little bit of a gap for shuttle, and a number of people left, but they didn't hire anybody new because all those engineers were still of an appropriate age, et cetera. So they go through the early stages of the shuttle program, then Challenger happens, and everything shuts down for a while until all the issues got taken care of.
When you say Challenger happened, for the listeners, that was the space shuttle Challenger, which exploded after liftoff in January of 1986, I believe.
Yeah, that's exactly it. And so, of course, you know, when that happened, like happened with the Columbia disaster in the early 2000s, you know, of course, they're not going to fly anymore until they understand exactly what went on with that. So nothing was happening for a period of years. And during that time, all these aging engineers started to leave the program, and they had brought in a few folks. But what you had was a bunch of old guys who really knew what was going on. Most of them were retiring. You had a few younger folks who knew nothing about what they were doing. Now, NASA, a lot of people think, oh, it's NASA and it's all, you know, working with spaceships and everything else. And primarily NASA, like most government organizations, is an oversight agency. So you sort of look at what the contractor does, making sure that they do it all, you know, the right way they're supposed to do it, et cetera.
Right.
And the problem was they had all these new engineers coming in who were supposed to oversee things who had zero experience, right? So how can you oversee something you don't really know?
Well, we're Lockheed Martin. We know what we're doing. No problem, kid.
Right. Well, that's exactly it. And you know, you want to avoid the very thing that was causing this gap to begin with, right? So.
Yeah.
So what they started to do was they started this program, that was meant to get NASA engineers hands-on experience. And it was in the space shuttle, experiments. So all the experiments that flew on the space shuttle would run through this organization. And we had NASA engineers. We were acting almost like contractors, in this. So we could get that direct experience with operations, et cetera. And then we even went one step further that our contractor counterparts wouldn't. We got trained in forklift operations, upright tigers, crane ops, turning torque wrenches, you know, all the stuff, right? We were able to do that. And we had special dispensation from the unions at the Space Center that we were allowed to do that. We rarely did, but we were allowed to if we wanted to. And that was ostensibly to get us all the direct hands-on experience that we needed to be able to oversee. And the idea was you'd bring an engineer in for 2 or 3 years, run them through this, and then they'd move on and you'd bring somebody else in and you'd kind of rotate people through. The problem was with that theory was it was such a cool job to have that nobody wanted to leave. So once you got in, everybody stayed. And so I was really lucky to be able to get into this. And it was, you know, we're climbing around spaceships, turning torque wrenches, you know, getting on board the orbiter right before launch and right after landing. And essentially, long-winded way of saying, what did we do? Any experiment, scientific
kind of
experiment.
Like payload, weight and balance and integration, electrical integration and stuff.
So I was a mechanical guy. I did all the, mm-hmm. I mean, literally turning the nuts and bolts, hooking up the cables and that kind of stuff. And so any experiment that flew on the shuttle, we would do the integration ahead of time. We'd kind of put stuff together. And then we would put that experiment onto whatever the carrier was. And there were a couple different types of carriers.
By carrier, you mean some sort of a payload holding device that created
exactly.
And provided the interface?
Yeah, and essentially there were two primary types of missions that were flown. They were what were called space labs, and that's the big cylindrical laboratory that sat in the payload bay of the orbiter, and it was connected to the crew cabin by this long tunnel.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's the space lab, and that had 17 racks. And then they were just like, if you've worked in any sort of engineering thing, you've seen the exact same 17 and a half inch equipment racks. By the way, 17 and a half inch is what stereo equipment used to be, because it would sit inside those racks as well.
The old one-year rack. Any XServes?
Yeah, I mean, it's sort of, right? I mean, because the same thing, servers, you know, server racks are the same size now. If you go into a data center today, you'd see the same size racks.
Sure.
And they would look almost identical, right? So we had 17 racks that would go down either side and would load these things up with experiments. And we'd put those together, would literally turn the screws. It was like a big erector set, turn the nuts and bolts to put those in, would connect the cables, those kind of things. And then our electrical counterparts would do all the testing. And right before launch, any life science that had to go in, we would, it was something called the MVAC, the Module Vertical Access Kit. Everything's an acronym. Literally, this book, 167 pages long, that had a bunch of acronyms in it, thousands of them. And this was one of them, was called MVAC. And we would lower a guy down in the bosun's chair, down through the tunnel, because everything's vertical, right? So you're not crawling through the tunnel anymore. You're vertical. So we're out at the pad. We have a big crane. We're lowering a guy down, and then we'd lower the life science down. It could be everything from frogs to live fish to, eggs of some sort or something, right? And we'd put that stuff in. So that was, that was sort of the space lab. And then we had another type that was called the pallets. And they were basically this big sort of concave pallets that would sit into the orbiter payload bay. And you'd put in on experiments onto those that would see the, be exposed to space when they'd open up the payload bay doors. So we had a bunch of really cool experiments that we worked on as a part of that.
Including the Hubble. And then there
was, including Hubble. Yeah, Hubble was one that sat in its. It wasn't technically a pallet, but it sort of sat in a very similar thing to a pallet mission. And then we also had these things called mid-deck experiments. And so what would happen there is that these were sort of little self-contained experiments that were either life science or time-critical science that once again would go in about 12 hours, 13 hours before launch. And in the front of the main area of the kind of crew cabin area of the shuttle or the orbiter is what they call the mid deck. And the front of that is this big thing with these, they're roughly 18 maybe by or 2 feet by a foot, somewhere in that range that were these lockers. And some of them would hold food and some of them would hold clothing and, those kind of things. And some of them were set aside for these sort of self-contained experiments. And so we would also put those in right before launch and take them out right after landing. So those were kind of the things that we did.
You mentioned in your bio that you also were involved in astronaut training. What did you have to train the astronauts about?
So, they'd come in. It was primarily on the stuff that would go in the space lab missions that we would run. And so there's a bunch of equipment, and we would get to be the ones who knew the most about it as we were putting it together. What are some of the hiccups you have to look out for and those kind of things? And so for every space lab mission, the astronauts would come through. Put their hands on the equipment, because they may have trained on simulators for this stuff for years, but they've never seen the real thing. And so so this would be their first chance to really put their hands on it, make sure the stuff that they need to do is all within reach, and see if there's anything that's at issue. And we'd find little things. I mean, one of my favorites was, and I got yelled at for it. I mean, it was one of these things, but I stood my grounds for it, because it made sense, which was one of the astronauts was like, I want to try the gloves on. And now, because of course you're wearing gloves when you do all this stuff, right? And even in space you're doing it. And we were like, yeah, we've already packed those away. And if we pull out one of those sets of gloves and you open it, we've got to go through a bunch of stuff to put it back in. And he's like, well, what if they don't fit? I'm like, okay, good point. And so, we pulled one of the packs out, and sure enough, he puts them on and the things just rip because they're too small for him. And so we had to get all new gloves and put them in. And, everyone yelled at me because we were holding up things to do that. And I was like, well, the alternative would have been we get up on orbit and
your gloves are ripped.
And the gloves are ripped.
And you started venting the vacuum.
Right. And actually, that was a mission, by the way, that one of the astronauts made us all cookies because we were being so accommodating.
Cool. Well, we've come to the end of segment one. In the second half of the show, I want to ask you about your science fiction writing career. But first, as usual, folks, we have to take a short commercial break. I'm chatting with Darren Beyer, former NASA shuttle engineer, and we'll be back in 60 seconds. Stay with us.
Hello there, all you fabulous background mode listeners. I'm Kelly Gamont with the Mac Observer, and I just want to say a few words about how you can support all the things we do. If you're thinking about buying something from Apple, Amazon, or Mac Mall, just go to the Mac Observer's homepage where we have a section called Support TMO. Or you can just enter macobserver.com/Apple Store, all one word, and that will take you to our special page for Apple and our other affiliates. If you make a purchase from one of our partners this way, the Mac Observer receives a small compensation for sending business their direction. Pretty cool, right? And you don't pay a penny more. This small fee from our affiliates helps us continue to bring you TMO's daily news, reviews, tips, how-tos, and podcasts like this one. So the next time you're thinking about an online purchase, come to TMO's homepage and support the Mac Observer. Thanks. Back to you, John.
Thanks, Kelly. I'm chatting with Darren Beyer. All right, so science fiction. A few years ago, you started delving into writing science fiction with a real strong technical background. What brought you into this? Certainly, it wasn't the money.
No. Yeah. I mean, anybody who thinks they're going to come in and write a book and make a ton of money, you know, be Andy Weir with The Martian. You know, that's literally one in a multi-million that's going to happen. Very, very difficult. It started with, I mean, honestly, I don't want to get into the politics of it, but it started with the second Iraq War. And it was after the World Trade Center stuff. And what happened there, you know, everybody knows we went into Iraq to look for weapons of mass destruction, didn't find them. At the time, I should have written a book about this because I would be a pundit on CNN right now. I called it before it happened. I said, we're shooting at the wrong target. North Korea is going to ascend. Iran is going to ascend. And we're going to be dealing with other problems here. And I was very frustrated with what I saw as sort of a corporate greed scenario where you have the big guys like Halliburton that are going to be making a mint off this and a lot of other people are going to be paying the price. And I felt I needed to do something about it. So I decided I was going to start writing, and they say to write what you know. And obviously I knew sort of science and science fiction. Sort of science fiction is what I meant to say. I've lived it, you know, for 10 years at NASA at that point. Mm-hmm. And I decided I would write a story that was, you know, on its surface, a science fiction book, and underneath was sort of a play against what was happening with respect to political and corporate corruption and greed. And that's sort of the underlying theme to the books that I'm writing.
And in parallel, putting the science back in science fiction because of your background. A lot of people have been clamoring for that because we went hard right into fantasy for a long time. I talked to science fiction author Alec Navalli a while back, and he has written a biography called Astounding, the Glory Years in the 40s and the 50s with Asimov and Heinlein and Arthur Clarke, not in his book, but one of the guys who was science-y, technical background. And those were the years when science and science fiction really took off and laid the groundwork for a lot of inspiration for a lot of us and a lot of great science fiction in the 50s and 60s. And as a science fiction reader myself, I've noticed that we've kind of lost that art. There are a few authors who are notable for that, Larry Niven and Jerry Pournelle, and a few others who have really good science background. So my hat's off to you. Thanks for doing that.
Yeah, well, I appreciate it. And for me, it was a frustration as you start. I mean, so I'll stipulate for the record, I really loved going to the Star Wars movies, the first ones. The later ones, I'm not real happy with. But the first ones when I was younger, and I loved them. I thought they were, you know, obviously a breakthrough.
Oh, you mean episodes 1, 2, and 3, the debacles?
Yeah.
And 6 were great, but 1, 2, 3,
Well, even if you go back and look at 4, 5, and 6 now, right? I mean, and put them in a today's lens, there's some lacking stuff there, right? So,
yeah.
You know, but they were so groundbreaking at the time, you know, loved them, but they're more fantasy than they are science fiction. You sort of alluded to that at the beginning. And so it wasn't those, but it was some other movies that followed on that you would see these things that were clearly not correct. And every time you do that, if there's somebody in the know, you run the risk of pulling them out of the fantasy that they're watching, right? They're pulling them out of the moment.
Like the Kessel Run in 12 parsecs.
Exactly. And they explained it away later that he was just cutting off distance and that's why he could do it in 12 parsecs. And I think that was a little bit of a
stretch. Yeah.
But, um, But so, you know, you would see these things like that that would pull you out. And part of the problem is and this is one of the reasons why I really strive for accuracy and things, is now with all the social media stuff and people getting bits and bytes of information from 30-second clips. I mean, that's what's happening now. That's where society's gone, is that so many people get their quote unquote history and quote unquote science knowledge and all of these other things through entertainment. And so often it's wrong.
Once in a while, you run across a movie where they get the right kind of consultants, like The Arrival with Amy Adams.
Exactly.
And then every once in a while, you get something where they just ignore the consultants or don't even bother with them at all, and we all groan.
So Gravity is one of my favorites.
Oh yeah. You
know, it won awards. I tell the same thing. Somebody who's listening to this who may have heard one of my other interviews, I say the exact same thing. I almost walked out of the theater in the first 5 minutes. If my wife had not been with me, I would not have seen the rest of
it. I understand.
But again, so many people get their ideas of what things are from the movies and from books and from TV that I feel that writers, especially when there's no reason not to do a little bit of research, when writers don't do that, they do a disservice, not just to the people watching their stuff, but to everybody, because everybody gets impacted by it in some way.
If you're not a good writer, you tend to get too geeky and you lose the reader because you're trying to show off how good you are in physics and aerospace. And it takes a really talented writer to write a compelling story like you have that's well-written and compelling and folds the science in a graceful, smart way instead of a oppressive way.
Well, that's it. I appreciate you saying that. I mean, I really push for that. I mean, as an example, I give this as an example quite a bit as well, is there's one scene in the movie. So Terminator 2 is a movie where they got a lot of stuff right. You know, I mean, they did so well in all the details in that movie, especially for when it was made. I mean, it's 20 years ago now. And one of the scenes in that movie that just made it for me was when Arnold's in the office building and he's firing the minigun out at all the cops. He's not killing anybody because he told the kid he wouldn't do it. Runs out of ammunition, and then he pulls out a grenade launcher and fires it at a cop car. And they're literally a quarter second of video is what this is. There's a quarter second where the grenade, you can see it in the air. You see it penetrate the window of the cop car. There's a 40-millimeter hole in the window for like 3 frames, and then the car explodes. And when you see that type of attention to detail paid like that in a movie, don't we owe it as writers, whether it's a screenwriter or an author, don't we owe it to our readers to do a little bit of research to get, at least from the fictional side, this stuff as close to real as we can get it?
Absolutely. Absolutely. So your female lead character is an African-American woman. You had some comments in your bio history to make about that. Tell me more.
Yeah, so this is a really interesting one, and I hadn't written that character to make a statement. A lot of people think I did that, and I get a lot of negative feedback, as a matter of fact, from people that are on one side of the political spectrum, or closer to alt-right or what have you. And it wasn't written as a political statement. It wasn't written as anything other than writing a cool character. So I wrote in somebody that I would like to know. I wrote somebody that I would like to see what they do and I could relate with, that had the most vivid background I could design. And it happened to be an African-American woman. Interestingly, she wasn't even meant to be the lead in the series. The first draft of the book, she was the secondary protagonist. And the primary one was sort of this corporate CEO, good guy, corporate CEO guy. And what was happening was I just wasn't embracing the manuscript. And a friend of mine who was test reading said, like Mandy, who's the character's name, Mandy's story is a heck of a lot more compelling than Jan's is. And as soon as he said that, I was like, you know what I need to do is I need to swap those two and make her the primary and him the secondary. And when I did that, everything changed. And that's how I fell into it. So I was blithely ignorant of sort of any of the cultural issues around having an African-American female protagonist as a main character in a science fiction series. It wasn't until I did a radio show with an African-American host who, that's the first thing he called out, was like, so let's talk about the 800-pound gorilla in the room, African-American female protagonist in science fiction. And he says, you're kind of ahead of your time. And I said, well, like, what do you mean? I said, I don't think I'm ahead of my time. And I was completely ignorant to how much women, number one, but especially people of color and people of color who are women have been marginalized or ignored in the genre. And now that's, and I think that I was part of the problem, right? Not knowing. I mean, it was just ignorant of the fact. But now I've done a bunch of research on it and showing that it's a very, very low percentage of women are in leading roles, whether it's in stories or in film. And when it comes to women of color, it's non-existent.
Are you planning a third novel in the Ngozi series?
Yeah, well,
I'd
already. Well, so interestingly, you're catching me after I've just made a momentous decision. So you know, one of the interesting things about when you write is you have the whole story, you have to get the storyline figured out, and you're like, I can do this, and it's almost like name that tune. I can do this in three books, right? And I got the first book done, and it was never really meant. The first book was never meant to go into a tremendous amount of the backstory. That was all going to start to come out in book two, and I was going to deliver a bunch of backstory in book two, and then in book three was going to be the conclusion of the series, where you know what's going on, and there's the good guys and the bad guys, and there's big galactic consequences, right? And I got into book two and realized I can't deliver probably 85% of what I want to deliver in this book. There's just not enough space. And so I ended up pulling a bunch of that stuff out. I was like, well, I guess I'll just have to move it into book three. And now I'm looking at, you know, part of the way through book three, and there's like, there's just no way I can deliver everything that needs to be delivered in three books. So I finally decided I'm going to four. I'm definitely going to be putting in at four, limiting it to that. I don't like these series that go on forever, but I've got to do that. Otherwise it's just too much. And that part of this was coming from people who were coming back to me with comments on book two going, boy, that could have been two books.
Yeah. I think Charlie Strauss ran into that problem. But his problem was with the editor, not with his own desires. So, yeah.
Yeah, well, and I'm like, oh my gosh, if this one, after I've pulled out 85% of the content already, like if this one could have been two books, there's no way I can do, you know, I can do the third one in two. But then the really fun thing I've got going, I'm really excited about, is a book I'm going to be launching that takes place about 40 years after this series. And it'll be a new series, same universe. And I've already got a title for it and everything. And it's, I don't want to go into too much detail on it, but I'm really, really excited to write it. It's something I don't believe has been done, before. And so I think it'll be a really fun, book to write and get out there.
Cool. Well, we're starting to run out of time, and I have a couple more questions I wanted to ask you about space exploration. In the few minutes we have remaining, can we kind of just tick off a few items here real quick?
Absolutely.
How do you feel about the 50th anniversary of the first moon landing coming up next summer? Have we squandered the last 50 years, or was it just all tech development that had to happen?
Well, if some of the things that haven't been happening in the private industry hadn't happened in the last few years, I would say we missed the boat. I think the shuttle, we sort of languished into just falling into this, let's keep launching missions and not really innovating. And there was a period of time, late 90s into the 2000s, where I just didn't feel like there was a ton of development going on. Now what's happening with the SpaceX stuff, with, you know, the stuff with Bezos' company and some of these others, mm-hmm. It's a lot of innovation going on. I mean, the Falcon Heavy, or the Falcon launch with the Roadster and the dual landings, that was the most exciting space related event I've watched since my first shuttle launch.
Do you think that there is a bit of a race between the private entrepreneurs, Bezos and Musk, to get us onto Mars because of the financing available, or do you think NASA will get there first?
NASA's not going to get there first. And I'm not even sure they should, to be honest with you. The focus has changed from Mars to the moon now. I actually think that's the right move. Believe it or not.
Actually, to become a space-faring species rather than a one-off spectacular stunt species.
That's been
my view for a long time.
Yeah, that's exactly it. And there's a tremendous amount of resources on the moon that you can get into orbit with like a mass driver, like a catapult, versus launching. It's a, you know, tremendously more efficient, et cetera. So you can use that as a building block instead of having to launch everything off the Earth. So I think that's the right move. I think there's a lot of dangers associated with sending people to Mars.
Do you think Elon Musk's tourist moon flight is a stunt or part of the technical development he needs?
I think it's both. I think you've got to. Yeah, I think you have to have both. I mean, you've got to do the PR to gin up the interest, which generates the capital, which then builds the infrastructure, et cetera. So, I think what the way he's doing it, what he did with the Falcon launch, the PR that he put around that, you know, the do not panic on the screen in the Roadster. I mean, it was brilliant, absolutely brilliant. And I'm not a huge Elon Musk fan. I'm not a fanboy of his, but that you've got to give credit, and the folks that were involved in that, you know, great job. It's a tough place to work from all accounts. You really get driven hard there, and that was some well-deserved accolades for them.
Cool. Well, with that, we're going to have to wrap up the show. We run out of time. So I want to thank you for this grand tour of your background at NASA Kennedy Space Center and your science fiction writing and your books and your observations about Mars. So it's been fun. Thanks for sharing with us and informing us.
Well, I really enjoyed it, John. Thanks.
Tell the listeners how they can contact you if they wish.
Sure. So you can go to my website, darrenbeyer.com, DarrenBeyer, on Twitter. I'm at Darren D. Beyer, and I've got Facebook, Darren D. Beyer as well. So a number of different ways to get a hold of me.
Okay, great. Well, thanks again. It was a pleasure.
Thank you.
Folks, you've been listening to the Mac Observer's Background Mode. We'll see you again next week.